Hello, and welcome to our Twitter Spaces conversation on today's CPI data release and inflation. Please give us just a moment to add our speakers before we get started. This conversation will be recorded, and the audio will be available after the space ends. If you have any questions for our experts during the discussion, please DM the Brookings account, and we will try to address them. Like I said, we'll get started in just a moment. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution, and I'm joined today by three very capable friends and colleagues of mine, Justin Wolfers of the University of Michigan, Wendy Edelberg of the Hamilton Project at Brookings, and Jason Furman of Harvard University. And we're going to talk today about the latest consumer price index data, which came out this morning. That the headlines actually are pretty alarming. Over the last 12 months, inflation has risen by 8.6%, but there's a lot of detail underneath it. So I'd like to start by asking each of you, is there anything in this report that you think is particularly noteworthy? And especially, is there anything here that would lead us to believe that inflation is peaking and it's going to be headed down? And Jason, why don't I start with you?
Sure. I think the headline numbers in this report are dreadful. If you strip away some of the special factors, it's merely a bad report. The media focuses on the 12-month change. There's some good reasons to look at that. That's 8.6% overall, 6.0% for core. I look at the monthly numbers, and in particular, the monthly core number was an 8% annual rate if inflation went at this pace. So that's actually a pickup in the pace of inflation that we've seen. Some of that was very special factors, but some of it, like shelter, is much more persistent and likely to last.
Can you just explain why you look at core? Core is, of course, the change in prices of everything except food and energy, which is where I spend a lot of my money.
Yeah. If you want to ask how a family is doing, you want to include food and energy. That's a big part of the cost that they're paying. If you want to predict what inflation is going to be going forward, it's better to ignore the things that are bouncing around in a very volatile way for global reasons like oil prices and food prices and focus just on everything else. That's a better predictor of where inflation is going to be a year from now. In terms of how people have done over the last year, you need to look at the overall inflation rate.
And Wendy, do you see things the way Jason does? And what did you see in this report that gave you hope or made you depressed this morning?
So, of course, I agree with Jason at the top line that much of the news was quite depressing. One thing that I have been looking for is the pivot from the story being all about what's happening in goods. So things that you can hold in your hand, whether or not that's cars or appliances or, exercise equipment, that sort of thing. And whether or not we're seeing the pivot from a huge run up in purchases and inflation of those sorts of goods to services as people become more comfortable with face-to-face services and go back to getting the medical services that they put off and, personal care and face to entertainment, those sorts of things. At the 1 month frequency, core goods inflation was pretty alarming, but, monthly numbers can be a little noisy. So if I look at the 3 month inflation rate, it's very clear that core goods inflation was just through the roof in the second half of 2021 and at the beginning of 2022. And it has come down since then as people have pivoted away from buying goods. Now, that's good news because it suggests that there might be a pivot where the economy is normalizing a little bit. But then, of course, the bad news is where we're really seeing inflation is in the services sector. But the pivot itself, I think, is good news if it means that we are starting to normalize.
And Justin, what did you see here that we should be sure to pay attention to?
I think there's no getting around the fact this was bad news this morning. you started by asking, you know, we were looking for the peak in inflation. Look, here's a super reach at trying to be optimistic. A peak happens after a high number. Well, it was a high number. you know, I think the more important thing is actually to step back and add a little bit of context, because any given day's report, you know, I think Wendy and Jason adequately described, perfectly described the numbers that we saw. We care about what inflation is going to be going forward. And that reflects a whole pastiche of different influences. Here, I think it's actually, I want to contrast the paths that Jason and I have taken. Jason's been an inflation pessimist, a grumpy Gus. He's been complaining about high inflation on the horizon for a long time. I've been an optimist. Right now, Jason looks a little bit more right than me. But on the flip side, Jason spent much of the past few months worried that it was going to feed through into higher wage pressure, and higher wages were then going to lead to higher prices. And so on days when wage numbers have come out, Jason is, it's sort of been the opposite. Wage pressure's back off quite a bit. And I think we're going to end up meeting in, I don't want to call it the happy middle, it's an unhappy middle, which is that the wage numbers, which really we do think of as the important medium-run driver of inflation, aren't that threatening. But the price numbers really are kind of miserable. And so how those two end up getting squared is an open question.
Okay, Jason. Yeah. So you're happy when wages don't rise and you feel satisfied when prices go up because your forecast was correct?
Look, I think Justin's exactly right. If you want to forecast inflation, you don't just want to take the CPI report and look at these numbers and figure out the best way to extrapolate them forward. There's a lot of other things and a lot of other data we know about the economy. I think that data taken as a totality says the underlying inflation rate may be around 4% rather than, you know, the 8% headline CPI we've had over the last year. I, you know, want to pick up something Wendy said. What she said, rather than comforting me, makes me extremely nervous. Last year, goods inflation was incredibly high. Services inflation was surprisingly low. And the net effect was high inflation. And so there was a story that was told that as the pandemic's behavioral impact eases, as people shift back from goods to services, as people return to the labor force, as things normalize, inflation will go away. Well, all of those things are basically happening sort of roughly according to plan. Goods inflation is falling, but now service inflation is picking up. And so the fact that we're seeing the normalization and core inflation, which, you know, was running at 7% last year, is running at 6.5% now over the last 3 months, has barely changed, I think should make us very nervous. That's one of the big reasons people said to expect inflation to slow down is playing out according to plan, except it's not slowing inflation. But I agree with Justin, the wage numbers tell me, you know, underlying inflation might be more like 4.
And the wage numbers also tell us, Jason, as you've pointed out, that for the average worker, well, who's getting raises, the raises are not sufficient to compensate for the increase in prices.
Yeah. There's not a lot of people getting 8.6% raise this year who stayed in the same job. There's some job switchers, especially lower income workers that aren't.
Can I just pause on Jason's point?
Just wait 1 second, Justin. If you want to ask a question, you can DM us at Brookings Inst. Okay, Justin, go ahead.
I just wanted listeners to pause and soak in Jason's point because it has some emotional resonance. We have one of our inflation warriors saying that underlying inflation is 4%. I agree he's roughly right. And I agree that that's worrying, but it's dramatically different than the headlines you're going to read tomorrow. So the Fed has work to do, but it's not quite the crisis you're going to see in 72-point font in the morning.
Wendy, one of the listeners, or whatever you call people who are on Twitter, asked, how do you think the administration and how do you think the Federal Reserve can and will respond to this inflation?
So at the very high level, both the Fed and fiscal policymakers are doing the most important things that they could be doing right now. So monetary policy is removing accommodation, and that is going to slow demand. One of the places where there's a little bit of good news here is that one sector where monetary policy is particularly effective is in the housing sector. Just, you know, think about the channel of, you know, you raise mortgage rates and that's going to slow demand for people purchasing homes. And because that's one of the significant places where we're seeing inflationary pressure, we can expect, it's not going to happen instantaneously, but we can expect that monetary policy is going to help bring down shelter inflation. So monetary policymakers are doing what they're supposed to do. The most important thing that fiscal policymakers are doing right now is they are allowing the fiscal support to go away. And we saw an enormous amount of fiscal support in 2020 and in early 2021. And that is a big reason why we're seeing the inflation numbers that we're seeing. And that has largely abated. And letting that happen is the most important thing that fiscal policymakers can do right now. There's some things around the edges that the administration can be doing and that they are doing in terms of improving supply chains, releasing oil from the, you know, from the reserves. But those are around the edges relative to the biggest factor of letting fiscal support ebb.
When you say fiscal support, you mean all the spending we made and some tax cuts during the COVID pandemic that are now the unemployment insurance, the economic impact payments, the aid to states, that those are all waning as because that period of the economy is over. I love to look at the details in the Consumer Price Index report because they get very incredibly fine grain. And just to note two interesting things I noticed. One is that used car prices, which have been going up a lot, fell for in March and April, but they're up again, 1.8% in May. On the other hand, for reasons I don't understand, uncooked beef steaks have been falling for 3 months. They're now down 4.2% over the last 3 months. And not good news for vegetarians, but for everybody else, beefsteak prices are rising less rapidly than all others. Somebody asked me, I don't know which one of you wants to take that, what parts of our society most impacted when inflation is as virulent as it is now?
I mean, I can go first. We have seen faster wage growth for lower income workers than for higher income workers. Over the last year, no group on average is keeping up with inflation, but it's been less bad for lower income. On the other hand, you know, that's a group that if, you know, you face a setback, even if it's a smaller setback in percentage terms, it's a much larger deal in terms of your life, in terms of what it means, in terms of your ability to afford things. So I think sort of looking beyond the precise distributional tables, you know, when something like this happens, it's the most vulnerable that are least able to cope with it.
Wendy.
So for sure, any household, particularly a household in a financially precarious situation, would be better off if their financial situation were exactly as it was, but the prices they faced at the grocery store and at the gas station and everywhere else were lower. So that's just an obvious point that inflation holding all else equal is a bad thing. But what we have to keep in mind is that people have also seen an extraordinary run-up in the value of their homes, in, if you're lucky enough to own stock, in the value of your stocks. And, you know, going back to the fiscal support I talked about, that fiscal support has boosted people's bank accounts. Now, it's waning, as I said, and so that's frustrating and alarming and worrying if you're seeing the size of your bank account fall every month. But in aggregate, and in fact, if we look at the averages of any particular group going all the way down the income distribution, the financial situation of households looks pretty healthy. One piece of evidence of this that people might not appreciate is that real spending on food, so that after we strip out inflation, the amount of food that people are buying at grocery stores and bringing into their homes is about 3% higher than trend. So I don't think that that demand for food explains the food inflation that we're seeing. I think that there's a more complicated story on the food front, but people are actually buying more real food. I don't know if that term resonates with people, but like actual food than we would have expected pre-pandemic, despite all of this inflation.
In general, if I were asking someone to talk about the midterms, I wouldn't pick three economists, but one of the listeners asked, what do we think the impact of these kind of inflation numbers is on the midterms? Anybody? It's pretty obvious. It's not good for the incumbents. That's basically, I would say, is my bottom line.
I mean, it's not good for the incumbents, and you didn't need these numbers to know the midterms. You could just walk out to the corner and look at the price of gasoline. And that's a really unfortunate irony, because of all the prices in this report, the one that the president and domestic U.S. economic policy have the least to do with is gasoline prices. And those are far and away the most salient politically, leading to all sorts of, you know, just generally idiotic debates from my vantage point when I had to be a part of them year after year.
And actually, can I just follow up on Jason's point there? There's quite a lot of evidence that, first of all, gasoline and secondly, food are the most salient prices, and particularly salient for inflation expectations, but also for their political salience. And so we're in an unfortunate moment where, yes, inflation is high. The headline number is 8.6. Jason thinks underlying is 4. But food is running at 12. Gasoline is, energy is running at 36, gasoline's running at 50. So the perceived inflation is probably dramatically worse than the reality. That's not to say, hey, don't worry about it. It's actually a reason to worry even more, because that can cause inflation expectations to rise and cause the next round of inflation. So we're in a particularly unlucky moment. We not only have inflation, we've got the wrong kinds of inflation from some perspectives.
Yeah, interesting. Somebody else asked a question about housing prices. That aren't there two different things going on here? There's obviously the short-term stuff that Wendy talked about. We had a big run-up in housing prices, and in some cases rents recently, and that has to do with interest rates and stuff. But don't we also have a longer-term problem of thinking about the supply of housing versus the demand and the demographics of the country?
So I actually think that those issues run headlong into each other to create the housing inflation that we've been seeing, in that over the past couple of years, we saw an increase in demand for some kinds of housing, and that ran headlong into a remarkably limited supply for that type of housing. And that led to an increase in rents in some areas and an increase in house prices in some areas that weren't even remotely offset by declines in house prices and declines in rent in the areas where people no longer wanted to live. So I don't think that this was an example of like a massive increase in demand for second homes or a huge explosion in household formation, where all of a sudden there were many more people who, like, you know, wanted to move out of their parents' houses and live by themselves. But it was people wanting probably larger homes in nicer areas, as long as they were going to be, you know, working from home for the rest of their lives. And it's just a limited supply.
Justin?
Just wanted to make a meta comment. We've seen many headlines over the past several months about the problems caused by high and rising house prices. And I want to make a forecast that if the Fed's higher interest rates cause house prices to fall, we will see an equal number of headlines about the problems of low or falling house prices. We kind of got to make our mind up, I think.
Right. But I think there is some evidence that zoning issues, the residue of the 2008-9 period, had left us with an inadequate supply of housing given the available demand.
I don't disagree, brother.
Jason, every time somebody at the Fed speaks, somewhere along the line, they use the phrase inflation expectation. What are they? And is this some kind of Tinkerbell thing where if we just pretend we're not going to have inflation, we won't?
Yeah, inflation expectations are a tricky thing. Normally, if you want to predict what's going to happen to inflation over the next year, the best thing to do is go do a survey of consumer expectations. If consumers think inflation is going to be high, then you bet that it's going to be low. If consumers think it's going to be low, you bet that it's going to be high. So consumer short-run expectations tell the opposite of what happens. And there's a good reason for that. When gasoline prices go up, consumers say, oh, wow, there's going to be a lot of inflation going forward. That's precisely when, you know, those prices peak and start to fall. So economists are mostly trained to disregard short-run expectations. And right now, long-run expectations have gone up a few tenths, but they're still well with, you know, not very far from 2%, not very far from where the Fed would like them to be. Now, that's normally, we'd say, those anchored expectations are a comfort. I'm more nervous that a statistical extrapolation about how things worked in the 25 years before the pandemic is relevant for where we are right now. Business expectations are very high. Financial markets are predicting that inflation will be 5% over the next year. Forecasters are predicting it's very high. So I think it might be that short-run expectations, which we're trained to disregard, may actually be more important than they normally are. And you know, get a couple of years in a row of higher inflation, I don't know that I trust and would rely that much on the anchored long-run expectations. I'm much more nervous about it than I normally would be.
Interesting. Somebody asked a question here, which I'm going to take the liberty of answering myself. And the person notes that we know that shelter prices are going to go up in the coming months because the way the government measures housing prices is largely based on what's happening to rents. And rents only change when someone gets a new lease. And so over time, we have every reason to believe that house shelter inflation will go up, shelter costs will go up, and that will boost the headline inflation. The writer says, isn't it, haven't households already borne the brunt of housing inflation? And I think the answer to that is no. If you haven't had a rent increase until your lease expires, you haven't borne the brunt yet. But as we look ahead, we can have every expectation that that will push the overall CPI up higher. So we got 5 minutes left. So I'd like each of you to say something that you think the 417 people listening to us on Twitter should know about inflation or the government response to it or whatever else in the economy you think is really important. Jason, you look like you want to start.
I think that the government right now is doing roughly the right thing. The most important thing the president has done is appoint good people to the Fed and give them space to do their job. I think there's some additional things he could do, like reduce the tariffs on China. They'd be meaningful. They wouldn't be huge, but mostly he's done, you know, the things that are on my list. In terms of the Fed, they're raising rates more quickly than I had called for, more quickly than Larry Summers had called for. They are acting very aggressively. I think the place where there's room for them to improve is that if I'm right, that this inflation is going to persist this way into next year, they're going to need to keep raising rates next year as well. And they need to do a better job preparing us that the Fed funds rate could easily go to something like 4. If they did that, long rates would rise more. That would help cool down the economy still further. So I have that sort of footnote to the Fed's communications about its future plans.
Let me ask one coda, which I'm going to ask Wendy and Justin. Do you think, what are the odds, Jason, that the Fed will provoke a recession as part of this campaign against inflation?
I am not super worried about a recession this year. There's a lot of momentum. Wendy talked about it before. In consumer spending, for example, some of their tools affect things with a lag. But, you know, the second half of next year past that, that's when I get more nervous because I think the Fed will have to go pretty far and could easily end up in that place. But, you know, huge caveats of huge uncertainty. No one knows the timing of any of this.
Wendy?
So I wanna start where Jason left off, which is talking about the cooling. The economy is on track to cool, not just because of monetary policy, but if we see cooling over the next few months, which I hope we do, I think that will largely be because of the results of the waning of fiscal policy, in fact, because monetary policy happens with enough of a lag. So the economy needs to cool, but there are two important points that I want to make about that. One, we are not currently in recession. I think one of the reasons why there's some hand wringing about whether or not we're in a recession right now, even though, again, let me say we are not currently in recession, is that I do think the good sector is probably in some ways in recession, as the demand for goods is actually contracting. But the economy needs to cool, and so we're going to see numbers over the next, hopefully, if things work as we hope they do, we're going to see numbers over the next 6 months of cooling. We're going to see slower jobs numbers. We're going to be slower spending numbers. We might see some outright declines for a month here, a month there. And it's going to be very hard to tease out whether or not that's good slowing or bad slowing. But let's not take each number of slowing as, those scary news.
Justin, the benediction.
Let me make one point to my fellow economists and one point to those of us who are also real people. To my fellow economists, this is still a pandemic-stricken economy. The models that we wrote down in 2019 don't apply. And we really need to continue to be intellectually flexible in thinking about how you move forward with a messed up supply side, potential shocks coming from China, a very hard to read demand side, and so on. And to the rest of us, we all understand the pain of inflation. And if prices rise by 8%, your wages rise by 3%, your spending power this year just fell by 5%, and that's very painful. But what I do know from looking at dozens of countries over hundreds of years is that the inflation rate does not determine over the medium run what your real wage, that is your spending power, will ultimately be. So there may be a year or two of pain, but one day, somehow, the experience is your wages are going to catch up. So the pain is real, but it's short run.
Thank you. So I want to thank Wendy, Jason, and Justin for joining us for half an hour and all the people who listened in and asked questions. Raman, do you have any last minute thoughts?
No, that was great, everyone. And thank you all for tuning in. We will be back in the future to cover inflation in upcoming months. So, follow all of the economists here and keep up with Brookings Inst. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.